you're on strike,
mm-hmm.
and you decide to do this march to Sacramento, but you call it a pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of clarify
mm-hmm.
what is the link between this, mm-hmm. this kind of religious concept
mm-hmm.
and this kind of, and also a labor struggle and a political struggle? How does that work, and what did it mean?
Well, a pilgrimage is like an offering because people are going to walk this 300 miles through the San Joaquin Valley. And so it's not just a march, so to speak, because and it's not a protest. It's more of an offering. And in this type of pilgrimage, you're not just thinking about the employers or the growers and how violent that they have been against the strikers, but it's also... and we set that tone very strongly at the beginning of the march because Cesar wanted the strikers to think about what they have done to injure others, whether it be in speech or in action, and in what ways could they become better people, and to reflect on that during the pilgrimage. And it was during the Lenten season. The Lenten season in the Catholic religion is that period of time. It's the 6 weeks before Easter, and it is a time of penance, right? When people in the Catholic religion, they usually give something up. It could be something as simple as candy, or doing a fast, you know, giving up a couple of meals a day, or one meal a day, whatever. But it's a time of penitence and of fasting, and it was during this period of time that this pilgrimage was taken. People who were on the pilgrimage, and many of them got blisters, and you know, they really were suffering, you know, while they were walking. But it was this type of an offering that they were doing, and it was all for the cause, you might say, for the cause, but also sort of a personal strengthening, you know, to strengthen themselves. In this whole action that we were taking of trying to build a union.
Okay. Now, some of the people marched all week, and I've heard the stories about how the children marched on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work, and what was going on behind the scenes to make sure that all, you know, that as you're moving along, these things were happening?
Well, as the pilgrimage was going from town to town, then people would greet the marchers every night. There would be food for them.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Another train.
I'm sorry. Okay, we're going to backtrack a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and then tell me a little bit about, you know, the strike happened in 1965, but obviously other things were mm-hmm. going on. Can you like describe what
mm-hmm.
how you were preparing and how you were organizing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned earlier that our plan was to have a general strike, right? So when we started organizing in 1962, we had house meetings with farm workers all over the Central Valley. And then we set up an office in Delano. We were doing service work for people. Farm workers have a lot of needs. And so they would come in with their income taxes so that we could fill their income taxes. The Bracero program had ended. That was one of our big projects, is to get rid of that captive worker program where they would bring the Mexican workers in, work them, and then send them back. And those workers were very, very exploited. Many times at the end of working for 2 weeks, they would have like a check for $15. And so we lobbied very hard in Washington to end that program, and we were successful. But then when that program ended, our government then gave a legalization program to the ex-braceros. So Caesar and I would fill out their immigration papers. And so that was one of the services that that we did. We did immigration work to immigrate families of the braceros and the braceros themselves to become legal residents of the United States. Then we would do some income taxes and other service work. We also passed a law that any farm workers, any farm worker families who did not earn enough money would be covered with an aid to needy children for underemployed parents if they didn't earn enough money. And so they were able to get supplemental monies and income to help those families. So we would, you know, take a lot of the farm workers to sign up for that supplemental income. And so we were doing all of these services then so that the people would have faith in what we were doing, and they would understand that we were building an organization, building a union. So we had all of this work was done 3 years before the strike started. So when the strike happened, the workers were already organized.
And they trusted you.
Well, in order for the workers to build an organization, we had to win their trust. And we did this by providing services for the workers so that they could see that we were not going to take advantage of them, and we were not out there to try to take their little bit of money that they had. We did charge dues, $3.50 a month, but we had an insurance program that was tied to the dues so that when anybody in the family died, that we had an insurance policy that covered that worker's death or that family member's death.
Okay. Now, let's go back to the strike. Now, some people marched all week. Some people could only march on the weekend. The kids marched on the weekend. But obviously, there was behind the scenes, there was lots going on to make this possible. Can you just kind of describe what was going on behind the scenes?
Well, I mentioned before, as the march was going from town to town, then people would meet them, and then they would join the march. And many families, of course, brought their children just to march during the weekends when they weren't in school. During the last week of the march, though, which was Holy Week, the week before Easter, then many families, you know, joined with their children on that last week of the march. So it was very, very dramatic. So, yes, people would shuffle back and forth. Then in Delano, which, of course, we had to continue the strike, carry on the picket lines every single day, both at the packing sheds and out there in the fields, we set up the first daycare center for farm worker children in Delano so that, because then the women had to take over the strike while many of the men were marching.
Okay, talk a little bit about the women, because you know, when we look at the footage, mm-hmm. Out there, there's women and children on the picket line, and I'm just wondering, was there ever a problem with women and their husbands, and, you know, giving them permission if that wasn't the case? Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
The strike was a very family oriented strike, because it was mothers and fathers with their children that were on those picket lines. And just as we spoke about the children joining mothers and fathers during weekends, the same thing happened on the strike line. You know, children joined the strikes. And also because before the march, there was no such thing as anybody to watch the kids, so they were forced to bring the children with them. And when we had many arrests, and some of the children actually even, you know, went to jail with their parents. So it was a very family oriented strike.
For kids watching this film, the idea of children going to jail would be rather shocking. I mean, you know, how did families cope with that kind of thing? Were parents? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of how did you deal with the fact that you were in there on the picket line, not only yourselves but with your children, and in since in danger. Mm-hmm. And what were the strikers thinking?
Well, the strikers really had no choice because they couldn't leave the children at home, and this is how important the strike was. The strike, it was the only way that we were going to win. At that point, we thought was to be able to win the strike by keeping strike breakers out of the fields. And so it was just an imperative that they had to be there, that they had to have the children with them. And it was better for them to be with the mothers and fathers on the picket line than to be left at home by themselves.
Thank you. Okay, that gives us some perspective. Because people, mm-hmm. you know, we also heard, you know, that, you know, the stories that, you know, a couple of folks have told the story, Yolanda, about taking little brother and sister, parents take little brother and sister, put them in a box, mm-hmm. so they didn't wander out.
Oh, yeah, that was during when they were working.
Mm-hmm. So this makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, on the last day of the march, you spoke at the state capitol. You gave a speech. We've seen it, we have it, and I was trying to we'd like to get a sense of what was going through your mind as you saw 10,000 marchers mm-hmm. come up, and you had to give that speech at the very end.
Well, I actually wrote the speech the night before, and but Caesar told me the night before the night before the day we had to give the speech, he says, I want you to give the speech at the Capitol, and so I had to stay up all night to write that speech. And Caesar and I talked, and he gave me some ideas. But then I wrote the speech all night, and then I had to mimeograph the speech. So when I was giving that speech at the Capitol, I hadn't slept in all night. I had driven all the way from Delano to Sacramento and arrived there about 11 o'clock. And then Caesar and I met, and then I had to just stay up all night to type the speech and to write it. And type it, and then mimeograph it on the Gestetner to have it so we could have copies that passed to the press.
But obviously because I watched your speech, mm-hmm. and it's a very moving speech. Was it, seeing all the people and knowing what was going on, did that give you that energy? Did it inspire you? What were you feeling?
Well, what I was feeling when I made that speech was probably cumulative of all of the organizing that we've been doing and of this, burning desire that, for the workers to get the kind of help that we needed to be able to organize the workers, and so they wouldn't have to continue to live in these miserable conditions that they were living in. So it was a speech, I think, that, just spoke to the, to the foundations of what we were doing. And we wanted to make it like a big statement to the world about what we were about, why the workers needed a union, and at the same time to recognize the people that were there with us at the Capitol, the people that had joined us that day.
You know, Bert Corona had mentioned that this was bigger. It was basically the Mexicanos, the Mexicans, the Mexican Americans standing up against, for the first time, I guess, to the state of California. Mm-hmm. Did you see it that way? Did you feel that we have to make this straight statement and tell the government we count? Or was that the kind of feeling?
Well, that's what the whole march was about, right? Taking it to the steps of the Capitol. See, we had dealt with Governor Brown before. He signed this legislation that I talked about that we had been able to lobby in the Community Service Organization. These bills for the take away the citizenship requirements for the disability, the getting disability insurance for farm workers, getting the right to vote, door to door, all of these bills. So we had dealt with him before, but then that day he was not there, and it was like. When we were a community group that didn't seem to threaten the employers in an economic sense, then we were okay. But then these were the farm workers, these were the poorest, and these were the people that were making demands, then it was a different story. Then the governor was not there to greet us at the Capitol. So I think part of that also was a disappointment, maybe some anger that was included in my feelings of that day. And also joy, because when we saw how many people were gathered there, then we knew that the farm workers were not alone, that we had all of these people that were there supporting us. And that was a very big message, because that meant that we were ultimately going to win.
I'm going to step back a little bit here, mm-hmm. get off of this track a little bit, and ask you about the Senate hearings when Bobby Kennedy came out the first mm-hmm. time. How did that just did not happen out of nowhere. Were you able to bring in a senator? Because you've been dealing on the state level before. How did that happen?
We had also dealt on the national level, because we had done the lobbying to get rid of the Bracero program. That was a federal law. So we had been dealing at the congressional level also. And Senator Kennedy had done fundraisers for us also, in terms of trying to raise money so that we could get a clinic for the strikers in Delano. And again, when we got them to bring out that hearing, that was just part of the work that we were doing. One thing about working in the community service organization, we had learned to do the political work. That was very much a big part of what we learned in CSO. And we just transferred that knowledge over to the Farm Workers Union.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. You had mentioned the Teatro Campesino, and I want to tell you, Luis told us a little bit about how the story about how it first started, I think he mentioned that he went to you for advice about the teatro, But it, you have to start on the picket lines. But we had, there was some encouragement from you. How did you see that Teatro del Campesino got started, and did you get a sense that there was an important role that they could play?
Well, I've always been one that has been very supportive of theater, but when Luis spoke to me, I suggested to him that he come to Delano. We were doing I was speaking at San Jose State again, getting support for the strike, and I suggested to Luis that he should come to Delano and that we would put an octo together, a skit, and then we would invite Cesar to come and see it. And so Luis went, and we got some of the strikers, and they did this skit, which was just absolutely hilarious. And, of course, Cesar came over and saw the skit, and he loved it. And then he and Luis, I guess, had a conversation when they made it, possible for Luis to come. And so Luis came and started the teatro. And that was what sustained the strike also, because every single week we had a meeting, every single Friday. It was the Friday night meeting, and the Teatro Campesino would do a new skit and new songs every single week. And so here we have these strikers that are, you know, out there every single day from early in the morning to late at night, you know, working on the strike. But then on Friday night is when people would bring the donations, bring the checks, and then, of course, the Teatro Campesino would be there to entertain us. So it was really the Teatro Campesino that was able to sustain the strike when people had nothing. People had nothing. And yet we were able to continue the strike, you know, month after month after month after month.
And that went on for years. For years. Okay. Now, what was... I mean, Teatro del Campesino was helpful in helping the strikers keep up their spirits. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how was it that people just didn't despair after a couple of years in the strike? You know, how did you do it?
Well, one of the things, of course, that happened is that we went on the boycott. Because, first of all, to put the strike into perspective, it was like a win or lose. If we didn't win in the strike, that meant that farm workers would never be able to change their conditions. That is how intense the feelings were. This was the only game in town. This was the, you know, win all, take all. So everybody that was in the strike was committed to win. We were going to stay there. And I remember when I was on the boycott, because I did the boycott in the East Coast, and when I would come back to Delano, and I would feel very, really bad because we hadn't won the strike yet. And the workers would say, "Don't worry, Ms. Huerta, we're going to win. We're going to win. Maybe we won't win this year, but we'll win next year." I mean, this was this feeling that we were going to win, and everybody felt that. And even if it would have taken us 10 years, I think people would have stayed there for 10 years. That's how strong the commitment was. I compare it to the Civil Rights Movement again. When we see what was going on simultaneously in the South, people were going to, you know, stay there until they changed and got rid of segregation, until they got rid of Jim Crow. And this is the way that the strikers in Delano felt. They were committed, it had to be for life, to make sure that the conditions changed for farm workers.
You yourself never had any doubts?
None of us had any doubts. We knew we were going to win. I mean, this was this feeling that we knew we were going to win. I mean, just the fact that we had the strike, and then we were able to organize the support, that we were able to get people like Senator Kennedy to come, and other people. We had movie actors like Steve Allen that came, Joe Cerda, who was our organizer in Los Angeles, actually brought up a whole busload of movie actors to come to the strike. It was like so intense every single day of the strike. There were many things that would happen during the course of a day, and then. So, you know, we saw that our support was growing and growing, and we just knew we were going to win.
Okay. Now, I think we went, the volunteers, the religious people, and the students, they played an important role, but could you have made it without them?
Well, the idea of the strike, again, of organizing, was to reach out to everyone. And When you say could we have made it without them, I think in terms of the strike itself, probably yes. In terms of the boycott, no, because we had to reach out to the American public. We had to take the strike out of Delano, and we had to take it out to the American public, because in Delano, the growers were getting injunctions on us, where before we could have 100 people on a picket line, they went to court, and they got injunctions. I mean, at one point, they had an injunction that we couldn't even have a T-shirt that would say Huelga on its strike. You couldn't have a flag with eagle on it. But we decided then we were going to take out the Virgin of Guadalupe to see if they would get an injunction on the Virgin. Of course, they never did. This is our standard that we have with the Virgin Mary, who was the, you might say, the patron saint of the Latinos, the Virgin of Guadalupe, who appeared in Mexico many centuries ago. They finally did get a final injunction that we could only have 5 people on a picket line. And so here you have a big 1,000-acre field, and you can only have 5 strikers on there. First of all, it was very dangerous because, again, the growers continued with their violence. But then also the strikebreakers couldn't see us, because if you only have 5 people, the people that they were bringing in to break the strike, you know, they could bring them in, they could work there all day long and never see 5 people that were on that picket line.
We're gonna pick it up again. Now, you told us that they got an injunction so that only 5 people could be on the picket line. But you tell us a little bit more about this, by why this was dangerous and what was the effect.
Well, having only 5 people on these 1,000-acre plantations of grapes was very dangerous because the people were out there alone and something could happen to them. Any type of violence could happen to any of these pickets and these workers, and nobody would know. I mean, this was before cell phones, right? So there was no way to communicate. When we had more than 5 people, they would arrest us. And, of course, we were being arrested often. We were being put in jail very often by the police. So it got to the point where, we just had to figure something else out, because with only 5 people on the picket line, you couldn't keep out the strike breakers, which meant that we were going to lose the strike after all of these, months of picketing. So that's when we decided that we had to do something different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's talk about the boycott. Something different was the boycott, and you said you had to take it out on a national level. Did you knew about boycotts? Did you have any idea that the extent that it was going to take, the amount of energy it was going to take, and the success it would eventually create?
Well, what actually happened is that we were sitting in Caesar's office. And we were we were having a meeting saying, what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do now? Our pickets aren't being effective anymore. The growers are bringing in more and more strikebreakers. We can't reach all the strikebreakers because we don't have enough pickets on the picket line. And there was an attorney from the Bay Area who had been volunteering to work with us. And he said, have you ever tried a boycott? And so we all said, and he said, well, you know, they were having the boycott in the Montgomery bus boycott. They were having that boycott. And then also the Congress of Racial Equality was having a boycott on dealerships, auto dealerships, because they weren't hiring African Americans. And so he said, well, why don't you try a boycott? And so we thought, oh, okay, let's try a boycott. I mean, what do we have to lose? At this point, we were losing the strike because they were bringing in so many strike breakers and we couldn't reach them. So we had some of the volunteers that they thumbed their way, really hitchhiked their way to St. Louis and to New York. And we did our first boycott, which was against a company called Schenley. So, and it worked. And so when we're doing the March to Sacramento, right in the middle of the March to Sacramento, this company, Schenley, which owned one of the vineyards in Delano, called and said they wanted to negotiate. So then we knew that we had a tactic, a nonviolent tactic that was going to work.
Okay. But you yourself went out on the boycott, and you went out to New York.
Yes.
And you understood what was going on. But with other folks on the boycott, other families that went out, Did people go willingly? Did they understand the way you did what was going on?
Oh, people volunteered to go on the boycott, and the first group, well, this is actually the second group, because we had a few of the volunteers that went out on the Shenley boycott, which was successful. It only took between the time we started the march to Sacramento and before we got to Sacramento, before the march ended, Shenley had decided to recognize the union, this one company. And so then the other group that we sent out, let me go back a little bit. Okay, the second boycott that we did was the Georgia boycott, the S&W Foods. And that one we did in California because that's where the label was sold, mostly in San Francisco. Cattle Campesina was also very influential in that. We actually did a big demonstration in front of their corporate offices in San Francisco where the teatro actually did an actual comedy act right in front of the corporate headquarters. So they decided to recognize the union, although we had some problems there because the Teamsters moved in on us the first time there, but we ultimately beat them in an election that we had. So then we decided to go after the largest grape grower, which was the Jamara Corporation. So then we sent, again, people out to the East Coast to do that boycott. But then what Jamara did, the growers all started switching labels. So before we knew it, Jamara was using 50 labels. So there was no way that we could boycott 50 labels. So at that point in time, I was in New York City. I had gone out to New York to help the people that were already there. And that's when we made the decision to do an all-grape boycott. And we had this one contract with DiGiorgio, which we had gotten after this boycott that we had done. And so we said, boycott all grapes except DiGiorgio grapes. And then that was our successful boycott.
Okay. Now, when people went on the boycott, I guess, I think it's redundant. People were convinced it would work because it worked before,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Now, meanwhile, in California, there was an escalation in violence.
Mm-hmm.
And what was going on with the workers? Were they starting to figure out, well, maybe we should fight violence with violence?
Well, there was not really an escalation of violence on the part of the workers. In part of the growers, there was some shootings, and they bombed one of our offices.
My assumption, no, the escalation on the part of the growers.
Yeah.
The growers were escalating.
Yeah, they're violent.
And meanwhile, there was nonviolence. But were people thinking,
Cesar was a little concerned. There was one person in particular that was always trying to advocate that they should become more militant. And during the 60s, there were groups that were advocating violence. And, you know, and they tried to influence some of the workers. But so that's when Cesar decided that he wanted to do his 25-day water only fast, because he wanted to make it very clear that this union was not going to be to use violence, and he wanted to make sure that the workers would not, you know, engage in any violent acts. So he fasted then for 25 days with a water only fast, to convince workers. And workers came out and they joined Cesar. They set up a tent city there in Delano at the 40 acres, and many workers were fasting along with Cesar when he was fasting. So that was quite remarkable.
But when Cesar decided to go on a fast,
it's going to take a while. This is
okay. Yes.